Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With a message for everyone paying big wireless way too much. Please, for the love of everything good in this world, stop. With Mint, you can get premium wireless for just $15 a month. Of course, if you enjoy overpaying, no judgments, but that's weird. Okay, one judgment. Anyway, give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan, equivalent to $15 per month required. Intro rate for 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode is brought to you by LifeLock. Not everyone is careful with your personal information, which might explain why there's a victim of identity theft every 5 seconds in the U.S. Fortunately, there's LifeLock. LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity. If your identity is stolen, a U.S.-based restoration specialist will fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Save up to 40% your first year by visiting LifeLock.com/podcast. Terms apply.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I'm so glad you're there. We had a big show coming your way. Rich Lowry at the bottom of the hour. Steve Myron, chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, in studio. And we have a lot happening today. We know that there's a lot of things, balls up the air diplomatically and domestically, as the Senate gets used to trying to handle the big, beautiful bill. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
According to the New York Times, Democrats are dropping $20 million on a new project. It's called Codenamed SAM, short for Speaking with American Men, a strategic plan. And it promises investment to study the syntax, language, and content that gains attention and virality in these spaces.
Yeah, Dems regrouping in a terrible way. They think they've got to win over men by spending $20 million and going to elite hotels. I'll explain.
Number two.
What Trump is basically doing is saying, actually, no, we're actually not going to do this anymore. We're not going to make the hardest working people subsidize the lives of the fabulously wealthy. We're going to do the opposite. We're going to take $3 billion from Harvard and give it to trade schools so that working class people can afford to buy homes.
Yes, Harvard, you can't win. As Trump gets more aggressive with the Ivy institution, why I believe the focus on Harvard has them losing, even if they end up winning somehow, some way in court.
Number one.
Any further step of Putin into the rest of Ukraine, we will immediately favorably consider requests for weapons and trainers on the ground. We have to make it plain that he's got to stop where he is.
Yep, that is Charles Krauthammer back in, get this, 2014, talking about the threat of Vladimir Putin. He knew exactly who he was. Meanwhile, Putin has pushed too far and loses his best ally in the West as his major offensive and insincere ceasefire talks have Trump ready to slap sanctions and I hope give Ukraine massive weapons to hold off the Russian war machine that really wants to get into gear this summer. Steve Myron joins us now, chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. Steve, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So just I might have put that mic closer to you. So first off, on there's must be some, even though it's not your area in particular, if it comes to sanctions, there are going to be economic sanctions more than weapons. What leverage do we have over Russia? Do you know?
Well, I think we've got lots of leverage. And to be clear, this isn't my area. I'm not part of the national security team. But I think the president has shown that, he's willing to use the tools at his disposal to achieve outcomes that are in the interest of the United States. And he's shown this over and over and over again. And he has said correctly that this war never would have started if he had been president the previous 4 years.
Right.
But you know what? I'm confident he's going to end it.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that, for example, in theory, one of the things that Congress wants me to do is sanction the central bank. In those type of command economies, when you sanction a central bank, what does that do to an economy?
So it really limits the ability to continue trading with the rest of the world. I mean, you know, there's secondary sanctions like the type that were applied to Venezuela. And I think that you can continue putting more sand in the wheels of the in the gears of how the financial system operates, and the financial system is really the lifeblood of a modern economy. So, you know, to reemphasize, this is not my area of expertise. I'm not on the national security team, but you know, I do think that the president is, you know, has tools available to him to achieve the outcomes that are good for America.
All right, so let's talk about the economy that we have right now. We know there's a few trade deals percolating, and Friday, after the president got fed up with the EU and said, I think we're just going to put blanket sanctions on them, 50%. Then he backed off and they had some constructive conversations. Overall, the consumer confidence is pretty strong. If you look at where it was in January, it was an all-time high, 104%. In February, it dropped to 98%, March, 92%, April, 85%, and then May ticked up from 85% to 98%. When you dive into those numbers, what's the reason behind it?
So the reason behind it is that Americans are understanding that President Trump is a pro-growth president, and President Trump created a healthy, vibrant, booming economy in his first term, and Americans are starting to understand that it's happening in the second term too. Now, you know, in the wake of the president's really historic actions in early April to start putting American workers and American firms on fair ground vis-a-vis the rest of the world, you know, to make sure to end decades of unsuccessful, failed America last trade policy, the president's moves on tariffs were really historic, right? Huge adjustments to tariffs rates. And this led to some financial market volatility, right? And that shouldn't be surprising. In the scope of such big market – in the scope of such big policy adjustments, there'd be financial market volatility. That reflected in the confidence data earlier in the year, and it's starting to peter out.
If you look at certain things like milk and eggs and chicken, it's the prices are slightly up from, let's say, for example, chicken per pound at $1.95. Now it's $2.06. When you look at bread, bananas, ground beef, it is slightly down. From your perch as chairman of the Economic Council, how do you affect that?
Well, what we want to do is we want to make it easier for farmers, easier for firms, easier for manufacturers, easier for producers of services. We want to make it easier for them to do business, right? We want to cut red tape that stops them from doing business. We want to cut taxes so that they keep more of the money that they make in their pockets, and that incentivizes them to work more, to produce more, to invest more. And by creating a situation in which the economy can produce more goods and services, you get prices down.
Okay. Let's talk about what is your stand on crypto and the administration?
Well, I think that crypto has been a very strong source of innovation thus far. And if you look at the long term of history, it's really innovation that powers economic growth. When you think about all the ways in which we're better off in one sense or another than people were 50 or 100 years ago, it's innovation. And crypto is a very profoundly important form of innovation. And I have no doubt that we're going to sort of continue to see that.
Change from the first time. Because in the beginning, the president said, you know, I don't like it. I think it's going to destabilize the dollar. And in the 4 years since he left, he's talked to a lot of people in the industry, came and spoke there as a keynote speaker, hired David Sachs as an AI czar. He was at the crypto conference. He is at the crypto conference right now. Cut 21 is what he talked about with consumer confidence and his area of expertise means. Cut 21.
Consumer confidence is hitting new highs and Bitcoin confidence is hitting new highs. I'm here at the Bitcoin conference. And this was a community that a year ago was completely under siege. They were being prosecuted. They were being persecuted. They were being subjected to lawfare. They just wanted to know what the rules were. They said, just give us fair rules and we'll abide by them. The Biden administration would never do that. And all the innovation was moving offshore. Today, President Trump has come in. He promised to make the United States the crypto capital of the planet. He's done that. He's gotten rid of the red tape, the bureaucracy. He's provided clear rules. And you can see that this community is thriving, they're grateful, and the innovation is happening here in the United States again. That's what's necessary for high tech.
So he feels the confidence, but he also knows he's bringing a new area. For people who worry that crypto means destabilization for the dollar, what should they know?
Yeah, so I think that's really wrong. I mean, if you think about it, stablecoins are one of the most explosive parts of the crypto industry that have gained so much
traction. How would you describe them?
Stablecoins. So stablecoins basically are crypto tokens that are pegged to the dollar. But what happens is that when you buy a stablecoin, whoever sold the stablecoin takes the money that you bought and puts it into something that's relatively stable value, like short-term dollar, you know, securities, treasury securities, stuff like that, right? And so when you get people in other countries buying stablecoins that are pegged to the dollar, essentially that ends up being inflows into our markets, right? And when that happens, it reinforces rather than degrades our financial system and reinforces rather than degrades dollar dominance.
So the big, beautiful bill passed the House. It's now in the Senate's lap. They want to make some changes to it. The president said, go ahead, have at it. The speaker said, please don't. Because I got some moderates and I got some Freedom Caucus people. They're very tenuous. I only got this through by one vote. Where do you stand?
So, look, we know that there's a thin margin in the House. And we know that in the end of the day, the House managed to pass the bill, which was fantastic. And we should all applaud the House for what they did. It was heroic. But at the end of the day, there's negotiations between the Senate and the House. And I'm confident that Congress will come together to get this bill done, because if they don't, it's going to be the biggest tax hike in history.
But there's people like Tom Massey and Rand Paul who don't care. They just want to sit on the sideline and say, well, this is bad.
I don't think that's the case. I don't think that they want to be responsible for a $4 trillion tax hike that plunges the economy into recession and throws 9 million people off of their health insurance.
They think the $2.2 trillion that CBO says is going to add to the deficit's a problem. How do you feel?
I think that the CBO looks at one tiny picture, one tiny corner of the picture, and not the whole. You got to look at the whole picture. There's going to be trillions, $4 trillion more revenue from getting growth to 3%. There's going to be about $3 trillion roughly revenue from tariffs. There's going to be additional several trillion dollars of cutting interest expenses because we get inflation down. All this stuff doesn't go into the CBO score, and yet people tend to focus on the CBO score because it's part of the legislative process. You got to look at the big picture.
And the CBO has a hard time with growth. They have a hard time forecasting growth, it seems.
They have a terrible time. And if you look at the track record, it's not good. So before the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which helped create President Trump's first economic boom, CBO thought there was going to be this huge hole in government revenues. And that's not the case. If you look at last year, revenues, real revenues, came in above where CBO predicted before the Tax Cut and Jobs Act was introduced. There was no long-term hole in revenues.
Steve Miron's with us now, chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors. Steve, people on the Democrats who want to characterize you guys as this is a tax break for billionaires. It's not what 2017 was. And just because President Trump is a billionaire, maybe David Sachs is a billionaire, they're allowing that characterization to go forward. You're somebody who doesn't get involved in politics. You're facts, you're numbers guy. What do the facts say about who's getting the break on this big, beautiful bill if it stays intact in the Senate?
Look, the facts are that in his first term, President Trump created a blue-collar boom in which wage growth for the lowest 10% of wage earners was about 2.5 times more than it had been in the Obama administration, right? That was more than double the gains over what the highest income people in the administration had in President Trump's first term. And this is well known. And this is why President Trump won in such a huge landslide in the election, because everybody knows that he created the best economy for folks at the lower end of the wage distribution. And the same thing is going to happen this time. When you look at no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, tax relief for seniors, right? These are going to the folks who need it most.
When you say tax relief for seniors, I got a lot of emails to me personally saying, what happens to Social Security, no tax on Social Security? What should you? What did you do? What did they do in the House?
So what you've got to understand is that it, because of the details of the legislative process, what's called reconciliation in Congress, which is how you can pass things with only 50 senators instead of 60 senators, you can't touch certain things. And that included that type of direct relief. So what they've done is provide tax relief for seniors in the form of a much bigger
$4,000 or something.
Yeah, that's meaningful, and that'll cover most Social Security recipients, right? But in order to sort of actually do that literally, right, you need 60 votes in the Senate, and the Democrats vote against it because the Democrats don't want to give that type of tax relief. And similarly, you know, every Democrat in the House voted for a $4 trillion tax hike on American consumers.
So here is what Elon Musk said yesterday to CBS, Cut 19.
So, you know, I was like disappointed to see the massive spending bill, frankly, which increases the budget deficit, not just decrease it, and undermines the work that the DOGE team is doing.
I actually thought that when this big, beautiful bill came along. I mean, like, everything he's done on DOGE gets wiped out in the first year.
I think a bill can be big or it can be beautiful. But I don't know if it can be both. My personal opinion.
Your thoughts?
Well, like I said before, I think you've got to look at the big picture. And the big picture that just looks at the CBO score is ignoring trillions of dollars of more revenue from tariffs, trillions of dollars of more revenue from better economic growth, trillions of dollars of more of less expenditure from lower interest rates as a result of killing inflation through pushing out the supply side of the economy through tax cuts and cutting regulations, right? And all of these things hugely outweigh the increase in the deficit the CBO predicts. And the CBO was wrong last time. They're going to be wrong this time, too.
What do you expect the Fed to do in terms of tax cuts this year? Not hope, but what do you think?
The Federal Reserve?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that inflation has come down a lot. If you look at the inflation prints for the last 2 months.
And that's why you raised the rates, to get it down.
Core inflation in the last couple of months was, I think, the lowest number since, I believe, March of 2021, right? So we've undone all of the Biden inflation, right? So there's good evidence that inflation is normalized. And I think it's critical to understand that President Trump's supply side policies of pushing out the supply side of the economy are extremely disinflationary. When you cut regulations, you cut red tape, companies can produce more, they can produce more cheaply, they can produce more easily, and when they produce more, price pressures go down. And I think that the Fed, the Fed will in time come to see that.
All right, and just I know it's not exactly your area, but in terms of the trade deals, we've heard some promising things about Canada. We hear that Japan's been closed and India's been closed for a couple of weeks now. What is Kevin Hassett and others telling you about this?
So as you correctly point out, I'm not a trade negotiator. That's not my remit, right?
But when they come to you, do they have you look at the deal?
We talk about some provisions, but I think you're going to see a flurry of activity in the next 5 weeks or so. There's the deadline that the president has set. Everyone is desperate to avoid a restoration of the tariffs that were the rates on April 2nd, because they know that those rates are terrible for their economies, right? They know that we hold all the leverage, that that trade as a share of the U.S. economy is much smaller than it is for other countries. They know that we're the world's largest, deepest, most reliable importer, and that gives us all the leverage. And so they're desperate to avoid a return to the tariff rates that prevailed before the April 9th pause. And so you're going to see a flurry of activity.
All right, Steve Myron, thanks so much. Chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors in studio. Thanks so much, Steve. Great insight. And the consumer confidence is up. That's at 98%, second highest since Trump took over. Appreciate it. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks for having me.
All right, back in a moment. Rich Lowry at the bottom of the hour. Don't move.
Learning something new every day on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor, editor-at-large of The Spectator, and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. I'm inviting you to join in-depth conversations every week on the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcast.com.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
The Democrats have forgot that maybe we should just talk to people like people. We don't need to do studies on it. We don't need to meet at hotels. How about we just go to community meetings?
It is not the question of what the party's image is, but is what does the party stand for? If the party takes positions on issues that are weak and woke, it will seem weak and woke.
Yeah, I don't think nationally the Democratic brand helps very much anyway. I mean, anywhere. If it did, we wouldn't have lost to Donald Trump twice.
Right. Instead of saying Donald Trump won on a fluke and then denying the reason, blaming it on Russia, and then having to do anything possible to get Joe Biden in and letting him not run the country for 4 years. Now you're saddled with a scandal and huge credibility issues. In fact, I believe anybody involved in that cabinet cannot even seek or expect to be successful with a higher office. It's not possible. Because other Democrats will point out who are running against you, unless they're also in the cabinet, that how could you overlook and not tell the truth to the American people? So the person who's going to get the nomination next would have to be a Governor Beshear, a Governor Westmore, somebody like, Dean Phillips to come forward. But what they were referring to in that first clip is they're going to these multimillion-dollar hotels to have conferences on how to win back men to the Democratic ticket and win back blue-collar and union workers. Really? So you go to an elite institution to debate things and debate things like how to win over men? You really have to go do that in an open forum? I don't know. Couldn't you find an office? Isn't there an RNC chairmanship with a boardroom? Isn't there a building? DNC. I think they are really hurting, especially when Rahm Emanuel comes out and says, the Democratic brand is toxic. You can't go in the left. We have to go to the middle. But guess what, Rahm Emanuel? Number one, you didn't govern like you were in the middle when you were mayor of Chicago. Number two is, even though you seemed to be an effective chief of staff, I don't know, and you did a good job with running the DNC and did a good job with Bill Clinton, in terms of running for office, he's not likable. And please tell me where the other moderates are in the party. Do you look at Michael Bennett as a moderate? I don't. I look at Fetterman and Joe Manchin as moderates. Fetterman's ignored, and Joe Manchin's retired. So he could go out and run. I don't think he's going to get any nomination. He'll get some money. Maybe Bill Clinton and Barack Obama will get behind him and kind of force the party. But does the party really want to hear from them? Remember, they led the way for Joe Biden twice. They did all the work the first time. And the second time, nobody wanted to hear him. I'm going to go inside what's happening with the media and Scott Pelley and his Wake Forest commencement address for Rich Lowry, and also talk about what Bill Maher just said about what should happen on college campuses.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
To move forward, we debate, not demonize. We discuss, not destroy. But in this moment, this morning, our sacred rule of law is under attack. Journalism is under attack. Universities are under attack. Freedom of speech is under attack.
So that is Scott Pelley's unhinged Wake Forest commencement address, at least the part I saw, where he looks absolutely emotional, loft script, smooth broadcaster, network anchorman, goes out there, and if you looked at his last three 60 Minutes broadcast, which he anchoring, it was all anti-Trump stuff. It's his anger at the lawsuit that Trump filed against 60 Minutes for them deceptively editing to make Kamala Harris look cogent in that edit, in that interview, which he turned down, first time in a long time. Anyone turned down 60 Minutes, but who wouldn't after the way Leslie Stahl treated him and dismissed the laptop and all the indiscretions in 2020, even though the President Trump, as far as I know, lost the election. Well, Biden got an unfathomable 82 million votes, which is nuts because he's never been popular his whole career. It's just he wasn't Donald Trump. So now Scott Pelley just goes off on his commencement address. I don't know. I didn't hear much applause. I don't think people want to hear it. And plus, do you want to bring up, Scott, the fact that Donald Trump was sued civilly from an invisible case from E.J. Carroll that nobody remembers happened and she doesn't remember the year lost? And how about sued civilly where he's on behalf of a bank that got all their money back and the president was forced to maybe give up his business if he didn't get bond and $450 million in that sham of a case in May? That isn't political targeting? Are you kidding me? Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, joins us now. Rich, I was stunned by Scott Pelley going to Wake Forest and saying what he said. Were you?
I guess it's maybe a little surprising. I mean, I'm not shocked that that's his point of view. Maybe I'm surprised that he aired it so publicly. And as you're referring to, on TV, he just got the perfect voice, the perfect manner. You know, he rose to be the key figure on this prestigious news show for a reason. But he was overwrought, unhinged, painful to listen to in that speech. And, you know, that's his view on Trump. Fine. You know, a lot of Americans have that view. I don't agree with it. But he's supposed to be an objective journalist. That's their whole thing. Right. We know it's not true. But how can he go back and sit in that chair at 60 Minutes with the ticking behind him and pretend to be an objective guy ever again? We know what he thinks. He's told us. So it's an opinion show in the guise of a news program, which is fine. I'm in favor of opinion journalism. That's what I do for a living. But that's not what he's supposed to be doing, or at least that's not what he tells himself and his viewers that he's doing.
Remember, 60 Minutes covered up for Joe Biden, never asked him any questions. He had Joe Biden one-on-one. You know, he really didn't say there's rumors that you're not even in charge of your own administration. You're a moderate, but you're running like a liberal. The border is wide open. You're running the country like a liberal. The border is wide open. Why do you allow that? Afghanistan was a calamity. Why don't you admit that? You know, you said before that your generals, no one gave you advice not to leave, but yet your generals, under sworn testimony, gave you advice not to leave. Who's telling the truth? Where's Scott Pelley's instincts when he sits down with Joe Biden?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. And also, would have been a pretty good topic for investigation, right? Groundbreaking investigation that he expects from 60 Minutes. they could have done that. What's up with Biden's health, you know? But they didn't, you know? Only a few folks did it, including the Wall Street Journal and the rest of the media slammed and shamed them for it. So I haven't watched 60 Minutes in for years. I will watch the clips, you know, something like a Kamala Harris interview or something like that. But otherwise, it's like most of the mainstream media. It's running on fumes and a shadow of what it used to be.
Also remember the 60 Minutes with Mike Wallace, even though you thought those were the glory years, they did sit on the story that smoking kills you and that was nicotine's addicting and the cigarette companies combining to get us addicted to these horrible carcinogens. And they did a whole movie with Russell Crowe about it. Remember that?
Yeah. Well, they've never played it straight. It's just they're worse than they ever ever were, and people are onto them to a greater extent than they used to be.
Absolutely. So I want to talk about what's happening at Harvard. The President of the United States is now saying international students are on hold for the whole country. He is now going after them. Remember, there was 1.3 million international students who came to our country. The White House is now directing federal agencies to cancel all remaining contracts with Harvard up to $100 million. Two senior Trump officials told many networks that the latest barb against the school is it refuses to bend to the White House's policy demands, which are stop the DEI, stop going by affirmative action. The Supreme Court made a ruling on that. Stop with the unscreened international students. We want to know their backgrounds and social media histories before you get in, or you're not going to get your money and your grants. And then they turn around, instead of doing it, they sue. So game on.
Yeah, so on the international students, I think it makes sense to have a clear standard for what they can do and say when they're here, and vet them beforehand. Because as we've seen in some of these cases, you know, it's much easier to let someone in than it is to get them out, right? So let's just have the screening happen beforehand. I think that makes sense. I think what Trump wants from Harvard would make Harvard a better school. I think there are going to be legal problems in terms of the arbitrariness and whether the courts will consider this impinging on Harvard's free speech. But look, Harvard's a fundamentally corrupt institution, just like the media is. It's almost impossible to be a conservative professor at Harvard. There's maybe one or two exceptions, but a huge swath of the humanities departments proselytize for a political and social point of view. And there's not academic freedom at Harvard, so it's a bit rich for them screaming academic freedom from the rooftops when you can't have one when you're, you know, a white male applying for a philosophy job there.
I think that's true. I want you to hear what Alan Dershowitz, he was there for decades, Cut 16. He talks about how it relates to all the anti-Semitism that we've seen and that is still raging with four major pro-Palestinian slash I say they got to be pro-Hamas groups. They've been running Hamas since the 80s. So Hamas been running the Palestinian organization for what, 30 years? Here's Dershowitz, Cut 16.
I predicted that what was going on at Harvard, these violent demonstrations, would lead to shootings. How did I predict it? Based on having represented in the past people who have been protesting violently during the Vietnam War and what became of them. One of them became a murderer, Kathy Boudin, the Weathermen. And so I predicted that this was going to happen. Harvard not only tolerates anti-Semitism, but two of its schools, the Divinity School and the Public Health School, actually teach anti-Semitism and encourage anti-Semitism.
So, and the anti-Semitism is where this all started. My analogy, Richie, you might want to use it, and I'm going to give you full authority.
It'd be a little trademark.
Sometimes you walk into a hotel room, you're like, that looks pretty clean. And then you get a blue light and you find out about all the stains that are there. So just by the examination of what Harvard does, the anti-Semitism that continues to show itself despite the scrutiny and the pressure, the faculty and what they believe in and their support for these pro-Palestinian, pro-Hamas students, By getting the blue light on how many international students make up their student body, how much money they're getting, how big their endowment is, they do not want this scrutiny, because most of the American public don't have the grades and the connections to get in there anyway. And then we find out that 27% are from other countries.
Yeah. So that's where the money is from the student body. I hope you don't travel with a blue light, Brian.
That's I don't. Right. I want to be in the dark.
Know.
I absolutely
look, to Dersh's point, when they're out there braying globalize the Intifada, what does that mean? What is the Intifada? The Intifada is about killing Jews in the Middle East. If you want to globalize it, you want to do it here, right? You want to bring it all around the world. And that's what we saw in those hideous attacks in Washington, D.C. And that Harvard anti-Semitism report, the Divinity School is all over it. You know, you'd think these would be the loving people, right, who want everyone to get along. But instead, it's this anti-Israel, anti-Semitic propagandizing.
So I want you to hear what Alan Garber said, the Harvard president, Cut 15.
What is perplexing is the measures that they have taken to address these that don't even hit the same people that they believe are causing the problems. Why cut off research funding? Shutting off that work does not help the country, even as it punishes Harvard. And it is hard to see the link between that and say anti-Semitism.
If you,
what's your answer to that?
Well, again, I think the institution is fundamentally corrupt. It's not just the anti-Semitism. It's the discrimination in the hiring. It's the DEI practices. It's the political discrimination in the hiring of faculty and the political proselytizing in the classroom. So all that runs very, very deep. But look, I think Harvard probably has a pretty good legal case, and maybe the best outcome here would be even if Trump ultimately loses in the Supreme Court on some of these cases that are going to come out of this, that Harvard kind of gets a message and does more to reform itself than it has to this point, so at least move the needle in the right direction.
So I want to give just real quick, Harvard, this is what the New York Post in the editorial said, and I have to agree. Harvard must end support and recognition of these student groups. The Harvard Palestinian Solidarity Committee, the Harvard Graduate Students for Palestine Committee, Law Students for Palestine, Students for Justice in Palestine, and the National Lawyers Guild are all putting money into organizations to organize against Israel for Palestine. What exactly are they going for? Are they pro-kidnapping hostages?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and what they've done since, I think, has been embarrassment. But it's really succeeding. I was talking to attorneys that representing hostage families. They have a direct link from Iran and from the Hamas organizations to groups like these.
Yeah, so definitely should follow the money. Now, look, it's your right to be wrong about Israel, right? And say things that are pro-Palestinian, anti-Israel. But it's when it's intimidation, when you're stopping people from going to class, that's where you cross the line, and that's what's been tolerated in elite colleges around the country, and it jumped, you know, the fence from elite colleges to streets around America. So if this had been nipped in the bud instantly at these campuses the way it should have been, it might have looked a lot different.
What is their attraction? It is anti-West, number one.
Yes.
And number two is, imagine if we saw organizations growing up all over the country pro-Taliban. Yeah, free speech. But what exactly is attracting you to the Taliban? What exactly? Is it the burqa? Is it the lack of women's rights? So don't tell me. I mean, what are you talking about? What is your attraction? You feel as though they want a homeland? Well, then tell me what's wrong with you. Why they walk away from the Oslo Accords? You know, why do they do this? This is an intellectual argument. The minute you start kidnapping people and putting babies into ovens, I really don't think I'd be protesting for that side. Lastly, do you think the president, and I don't give you enough time for this, the president is so upset with Vladimir Putin. You know what he said on camera. He said it on Sunday. He put it out on Truth Social again. Medvedev, the former president, has fired back at the president, saying that World War III could be the ramifications if you come back with severe action. Do you think the president has reached a point of no return with Vladimir Putin?
I hope so. I mean, we've talked about this for weeks, right? The play has to be, okay, Vladimir, you won't come along? Then Ukraine gets more weapons with fewer restrictions. I hope you enjoy it and come talk to me when you're ready to be serious about negotiations. I hope that's where we're getting.
Me too. Rich Lowry, thanks so much. Editor of National
Review. Thanks, Brian.
All right, back in a moment. I'll take your calls, 1-866-408-7669. Also, Bill Maher seems to have gotten this right, too. I'll let you hear what he had to say about what we just discussed.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
That's what's so ironic about liberals being so supportive of Hamas is because you're liberals, and these are the people. I'm sorry, but this ideology, Islam, even in its more benign forms, yes, I agree. The vast majority of Muslims, not terrorists, of course, but Islamists, which is the word we use to describe people who are not terrorists, but kind of agree with the things terrorists are doing and are for, that's a much higher number. That's many millions of people.
So Bill Maher making more and more sense. That's why we played it. He's just right. It's used to not be a Democratic-Republican thing to support Israel. Doesn't mean you have to support everything. My goodness, they don't support everything in Israel on Israelis. If you read the Jerusalem Post, which I get, and the Israeli Times, which it's easy to doubt, you get it right off Drudge. They're arguing. Nothing wrong with that. But just know who your friends are. You know, we argue with Germany. They're still our ally. We argue We have we were just brawling with Canada. You know who your friends are. I just wonder here in this country, with those murders last week, I just think that it's so much a bigger story than the tragic loss of two seem to be fine people about to get married. I just think when they chant the same thing they do on the college campuses, and you know, the elite college campuses, there's a real investment. And the killer, by the way, with groups that were financed by China and others, Qatar, and with there's a real push now to undermine American society and undermine Israel. They can't get rid of Israel unless they get rid of America's alliance with Israel. It's part of the bigger picture, in my view. So I think that it's important to bring up. I think that he thinks it's important to bring up. I think Christians and Jews are on the same page on that, and I think clear-thinking Muslims also. We also have another issue with the whole education thing, and that is who's getting the money. So we have $53 billion that are held up. We're not going to Harvard, okay? $100 million is also being held back from Harvard, and now they're holding back on international students. So we'll see about that money coming in. So what the President of the United States has brought up is, let's take the money we're giving to Harvard, who's got this huge endowment, and let's give it to maybe some scholarships, to some industrial schools, some trade schools. Mike Rowe heard this and loved the idea. Cut 43.
The Ivy League, I'm sorry to say, has beclowned themselves in recent months, and Harvard has led the beclowning. Part of what I love about the president's post is the fact that it's going to force conversations like this one. And a lot of taxpayers, mm-hmm. Chris, for the first time, are going to realize that the Harvard Corporation is sitting on a $54 billion endowment. Their president is currently screaming that this post and the idea that they could lose their tax-exempt status and some of these grants and tax money, the idea that that could happen are, in his words, unconstitutional. Now, I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but I think he's mistaken. And I think that the optics here are terrible. And the first shoe to drop is going to be a gobsmacking realization on the part of a lot of regular Americans that this university is already sitting on $54 billion.
Right. And that's when it goes back to my original point, which I think is underappreciated by the control room of Pete, Justin, because Eric's out today, and Allison, because the blue light was really what Mike Rowe just said. They lose with the scrutiny. They forget about the money's important, but with the scrutiny, further divides Harvard from the rest of the country. And then when I go to hire people, I know I'm from Harvard, but I'm really a hard worker. I know I'm from Harvard, but I'm not one of those protesters. I know I'm from Harvard, but I don't hate America. They're going to have to say that at Columbia and Harvard and Yale. I mean, I can't believe we're saying that.
I know, and I think you guys had on Fox News this morning how the administration is just always, like, putting up these issues that then make Dems on the wrong side of, like, common sense.
Yeah. Kilmar. Go to Kilmar in El Salvador, the white beater. The white beater gangster who, by the way, has tattoos that says he is MS-13.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest-growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Thanks so much for being here, everybody. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. I come to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan. Heard around the country, around the world. Bottom of the hour, comedian Adam Hunter, fresh off his appearance on Gutfeld last night. You see him all the time. Very successful out in Los Angeles, where he loves wasting money on high taxes. Bret Baier is standing by. Who doesn't? That's why he moved to Florida. More on that later. Where we look at Brett's taxes. But actually, ironically, Brett did a whole show on Fox Nation about the history of taxes. So I don't know how I stumbled into this brilliant talking point that Brett would shine on. But before we get to Brett and all the other breaking news that's happening within this hour, let's get to the big three.
Number three.
According to the New York Times, Democrats are dropping $20 million on a new project. It's called Codenamed SAM, short for Speaking with American Men, a strategic plan, and it promises investment to study the syntax, language, and content that gains attention and virality in these spaces.
Wow, that was tough to read and say, even for Dana Perino. The Dems are regrouping in terrible ways with a terrible message. I'll explain.
Number two.
What Trump is basically doing is saying, actually, no, we're actually not going to do this anymore. We're not going to make the hardest working people subsidize the lives of the fabulously wealthy. We're going to do the opposite. We're going to take $3 billion from Harvard and give it to trade schools so that working class people can afford to buy homes.
Harvard, you can't win. As President Trump gets more aggressive with the Ivy institution, why I believe the focus on Harvard has them losing, even if they end up winning somehow on some, in some cases in court.
Number one.
Any further step of Putin into the rest of Ukraine, we will immediately favorably consider requests for weapons and trainers on the ground. We have to make it plain that he's got to stop where he is.
That is Charles Krauthammer back in 2014. He knew exactly who Vladimir Putin is and what he wanted to do with Ukraine. Vladimir Putin pushed too far and loses his best ally in the West, and I'm talking about President Trump. He's got a major offensive coming this summer, and his insincere ceasefire talks have Trump ready to slap sanctions and I hope give Ukraine massive weapons that they want to buy to hold off the Russian war machine, which helps us too. And joining us now is Brett Baer, chief political anchor of Fox News. He's got a big interview tonight with Kash Patel. He's going to come to you from Quantico, Virginia, the site of the FBI Academy. Hey, Brett, welcome back.
Thanks, Brian.
So it's going to be a great show. Are you on remote right now? You on the road?
We leave in a couple minutes. It's rainy and ugly here, and we're going to head down to Quantico. It should be a fascinating day. It hasn't been, you know, the focus of any TV, so it's first time kind of being having a live show from there, and we will do the show and do a long form interview with Kash Patel, and then as we do in these remote things, kind of show you around and give you a little history of the place.
All right, so you're going to do some stand-ups in the rain. That's what it sounds like, Brett.
Yes, it is.
All right, so we'll talk about that a little bit more in a while. First off, we're at the point now where many people thought was inevitable, that Donald Trump is totally fed up with Vladimir Putin, and essentially he's making the president look bad and going out of his way to get more aggressive and bomb over the weekend, probably worse than ever. And there's proof now of a major summer offensive. This after the president puts his prestige on the line, breaks from NATO and starts going one-on-one and taking on Zelensky to try to get this thing, this war to stop. Do you think the president has reached his point of no return?
I think by what he said is a complete turnaround. You know, the rhetoric is much different. And really the question is whether that changes the action. And I think it will. You know, there's this bill up in the Senate, Lindsey Graham's bill, and there's 82 co-sponsors. You can't get 82 senators to agree on anything. And it is dealing with sanctions on Russian oil and tangentially on anybody that takes Russian oil. You know, India is a country that does a lot of that and repurposes it in the face of sanctions. And so I think there may be an effort to kind of move forward with that. I think that the rhetoric changes the dynamic. And, you know, Russia's economy is not cooking despite all the, you know, propaganda. It is a lot is going into ammunition, and they're not seeing, you know, oil prices. They're not covering what they need to cover. So I think they're vulnerable if the president puts the screws to them.
So when this president tries to increase oil production and get per barrel down to $60 a barrel, it really hurts the war machine of Vladimir Putin. There's a big story in the Wall Street Journal today that says Putin has retooled the Russian economy to focus only on war. So if you make howitzers, if you're making tanks, if you're making ammo and using tons of steel, and that's how you do most of your employment through government-sponsored money, how do you stop it? Which brings me to what J.D. Vance said at the Vatican. He doesn't know if Vladimir Putin knows how to stop it.
Yeah, and I think that's right. I mean, he is all in, and Putin is a different animal. I mean, he may say, I'm open to talking about a ceasefire, and then the next night have the largest drone attack on Kyiv that we've seen since the beginning of the war. So I think it has pushed Trump to a point of no return. And, you know, I think pressure would be an effort to try to get Putin back to the table, but understanding that Putin is a different kind of guy.
Here's what Kimberly Strassel, the Wall Street Journal, said yesterday should happen now, cut five.
It depends on whether or not Trump now decides to back any of this up with something more concrete, because the status quo that we have at the moment is largely because there hasn't been anything concrete. And I think what he's finally beginning to understand, I hope he's beginning to understand, is that harumphing and scolding Vladimir Putin online is not going to help, nor is suggesting that you're not going to back Ukraine up with real military equipment, et cetera, because it just allows Putin to string him along. So that's basically a challenge that was thrown out by Medvedev there, saying, well, what are you going to do? You're going to back it up? And I guess we'll see.
You know, Lavrov, with a little bit more subtlety than Medvedev, he says he claimed that President Trump's angry denunciation of Russia airstrikes against Ukraine, is which he called Putin's crazy, say it was actually reflective of Trump's frustration with the Europeans who are sabotaging his peace effort. So Lavrov showing a little bit of diplomatic skill.
Yeah. Medvedev was a little bit more blunt about World War III. And I think that has always been in the back of President Trump's mind about trying to avoid escalation. But at some point, you need to push the envelope and
yes,
you know, say, where is this going to stop? And I think that we're at that point.
I do, too. But I would love to see them buy Patriots from us. I would love to see them buy weapons from us. They said they have the money now. They are able to ship out a lot of their agricultural products. They've cleared out the Black Sea themselves. So I think it's going to be interesting. You played Charles Krauthammer last night and how prescient he is of what the problem that Putin will always be. Cut four.
We have to reassure NATO that it's going to stop with Ukraine. We should offer large-scale maneuvers with the states that are on the frontier of Ukraine, the NATO states, Poland, Slovakia, Hungary, and Romania. And what we should do is to announce that any further step of Putin into the rest of Ukraine, we will immediately favorably consider requests for weapons and trainers on the ground. I mean, Putin wants the Crimean Peninsula. He's got it. But if he's thinking about going west to Odessa or north to Kharkiv, Russian-speaking areas, we have to make it plain that he's got to stop where he is.
It's amazing how right he was.
Yeah. He was always had the ability to cut through the noise and kind of get to the heart of the matter. That was in 2014. Remember when President Obama said this cannot stand and Russia's aggression to Crimea and crossing over into that, it cannot stand. And then within 3 days, the people there had new passports and a new time zone, and Russia controlled Crimea. So, you know, he was looking at that point saying we have to stop, because Putin is a different kind of animal and will likely continue to go at some point. And he was right. He also said Putin is a liar and a very good liar. You know, he's KGB. And Charles could see that from the beginning and always got that right.
All right. Last night you did also talk about the Golden Dome with Jim Taslid. He is the CEO of Lockheed Martin. We're going to go. I went to NORAD a month ago, and they talked to me. The general that was in the Oval Office explaining it says Golden Dome is very possible. And this is what you asked him, Jim. And you also brought up a great point. You guys tried to get the F-35 off the ground. It was way over budget and was way late. What's going to be different now? And you also asked this, cut 13.
How much is it going to cost, and how long is it going to take?
Well, Brett, the U.S. government's going to figure out the priorities they have and the timing that they will want to have those priorities accomplished. So there's really three things you got to consider there. One is, what's the geography you're trying to protect? What's the location and what's the area of that geography? What types of attacks are you trying to protect against? Is it drones, small drones, large ones, hypersonic missiles, ballistic missiles? Which of those types of attacks or all of them do you want to protect that geography?
So what was your takeaway from that?
I think, one, it's a little amorphous, you know, like what it looks like specifically. It's early in the game. But two, I think they're going to throw a lot at it, not just one company, but a lot of different companies. And tech you know, companies. And I wouldn't be surprised if Elon Musk is somehow in the mix, and Meta and other, you know, big tech that somehow integrates with this giant system. And it's a major, I think about Iron Dome in Israel and what that protects. This is protecting the U.S., and it would be a major undertaking and costs a lot of money. That said, I think there's a commitment to it, and it seems like it's going to be a reality. It's just a matter of, you know, Congress getting their head around it.
Exactly, and there's got to be a situation where you can modernize with the increased threats, obviously. And then you look at the China, Russia, and North Korea is upset by it. That makes me think it's going to work. Finally, the big, beautiful bill, God, it has a critic, and it's Elon Musk. Cut 19.
So, you know, I was, like, disappointed to see the massive spending bill, frankly, which increases the budget deficit, not just decrease it, and undermines the work that the DOGE team is doing.
I actually thought that when this big, beautiful bill came along. I mean, like, everything he's done on DOGE gets wiped out in the first year.
I think a bill can be big, or it can be beautiful. But I don't know if it can be both. My personal opinion.
Well, he's disagreed with the president before, definitely on the tariffs, too. What do you think? How do you think that sits in the White House?
There's no denying about that the cost savings, which isn't there. You know, in the big picture, if you look at some of the analysis, you look at $2 to $5 trillion over 10 years being added. So, you know, conservatives that are looking to cut government, this is not that. And so it does go counter to what DOGE has been trying to do. That said, you know, the DOGE stuff is not in this bill. And it can't be because of certain rules with reconciliation. Could they do something separately in the appropriations process and get those cuts in there? Yes, but it's not right away to codify that into law. And I think there's a little bit of frustration in the DOGE guys because they know what they see, and they obviously see how Washington works.
Well, yeah, I guess they weren't able to break it. Governor DeSantis on the record saying the swamp won, which I think that's a little severe because they did set up the new systems and way of doing things that came out in your interview and what Jesse did following up. So, Brett, if I do your panel tomorrow, how will it affect me going to the Knick game after? I mean, do you provide transportation to get me to Madison Square Garden?
I'm going.
You're going to the Knick game?
With Harold Ford Jr.
Wait a second. We tried this once before. To go someplace together, and it went terribly wrong.
I know, and you took me on the subway,
but Harold Ford.
I mean, it was raining.
Harold Ford, his card didn't work, and we couldn't get through. And then I had too many swipes on my credit card, and then
it was fairly embarrassing. Like we were going back and forth with the card. You know, I'm all for the subway, but it was a little tough. But
all right.
Anyway, we're all set.
All right, so you're not going to go over 10 minutes to Laura's show? We'll be able to get to the game on time?
No. We'll be out at 6:59.
Right, great. All right, so I accept your challenge of doing the Brett Baer panel. Thank you very much.
Excellent.
And then we'll go to the game together. All right?
It sounds good.
Go get him, Brett Baer. And good luck tonight at the FBI Training Center. It's going to be great. Back in a moment.
Coming to you on a need-to-know basis, because, man, do you need to know. It's Brian Kilmeade. A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
She was right, and I was wrong. I did not see in the moments he was having, I did not see that as cognitive decline. She did. Our reporting suggests that she was correct. So I feel humility. I've apologized to her.
Jake Tapper called me about 2 months ago, actually. And he said, I have this book coming out. And I know everybody's saying that I should apologize to you. I plan, whenever the book comes out, to go on TV and I will say, you were right and I was wrong. It feels a little bit too late to me. I do appreciate that he did keep his word, though, and come out and say that I was right.
So I guess it does seem weird. It doesn't seem the apology. I would just call up if I'm Jake and just say, listen, the way I treated you, the way I cut you down, the way I accused you of making fun of Joe Biden's stutter, which I forgot about that. Remember that when you used to say things about Joe Biden's halting speech? Oh, you don't, you know, he's a stutterer. Really? For 50 years, he wasn't. And because he was a teenager or a 9-year-old and was, we can't say anything about the fact he makes no sense at all. And I don't really see a hesitation that comes with a stutter. But being that, that doesn't seem like the apology that he queued it up with Megyn Kelly. You heard the Megyn Kelly interview, right?
No, I did. I know. Hearing Lara's reaction to it definitely was not how he put it forward. But, I mean, I guess he did call to apologize. But, you know, a day late and a dollar short, and he's saying he was wrong on all of these things. But you just hope going forward he'll be more skeptical.
Well, the only thing that Megyn, I might have missed this, that did not bring up with Jake Tapper is the laptop and the Russia stuff. To say, like, you guys were ruined. This is the third time you ran with a storyline for months, pushed back on one, on two of them, and stoked the flames of the first. They were just totally wrong.
Yeah, I did not hear that either. I think they were, like, a little short on time. And she did, for her audience, which I understand, went after him about all, like, playing flashback clips of what he was reporting then and how wrong he was. Which I get while she was doing that, but I almost wish she did that a little shorter and talked more about the book and the reporting in the book. But I didn't hear the Russia stuff either.
I just can't know why, because the biggest story or the second biggest story in the book, first is the revelations. The second biggest story is who wrote it. And like, really, the person that should have unmasked it wrote it. I mean, and the thing is, if he didn't write it, then it would have been a massive pushback. Not the truth. Some conservative writer just is making stuff up to make Trump look good. But he writes it. Almost as a way to say we have to put to bed the Biden story by using a conservative, a liberal journalist to write it. So no one will say it's not true, because now everybody knows it's true.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back, and Adam Hunter has extended his stay in New York and not being Los Angeles to be on our show. Adam, I'm honored. Great job last night.
Thank you.
I wasn't aware that you're writing every day with Craig.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm technically freelance, but yeah, every day I come up with like the monologues, not like help with the monologues, but also do like the jokes up top. Of like,
which I think are hysterical. I mean, it's more than just the monologue now. Start off with some jokes, then you get to the monologue theme.
Yeah.
It's a lot of writing.
It's a lot. I write like 20 to 25 jokes per day. And then, you know, sometimes three will get in, sometimes four, sometimes six, sometimes one. It's like, right. I mean, it's a lot of really great writers. Like,
when you leave the room, do you know if your stuff is in? When you guys, because you have your meetings every day, right?
Yeah, pretty much. What happens is like, I usually do it the night before because I'm in California. So I'm up, you know, whatever, 4 or 5 hours just coming out, looking through, like, they'll send me like a list of like 6 pages of like topics of like links to articles.
And then will you find the jokes in each one of those stories?
Yeah, I go through all the stories, and sometimes it's just like it's a 30-page link and I'm just like, I can't. And then other times it's like easier. It's like in the, they'll be like, you know, it's in the topic itself. And then I'll like submit them, and then the next day we have a meeting with like me and like Joe Mackey and Gene and Joe DeVito and Greg. And then Greg will be like, okay. And we go through the jokes and he'll be like, all right, need a new punchline for this. Need a punchline for that. Need this, need that. And sometimes it's hard because I'll like give him 4 different alternative punchlines. And then he'll be like, all right, need a new one for this. But it's also, I do them like in like Greg's voice at night. So right, I'm up right there going, and like,
and you're still writing for yourself. Because you do stand-up.
Yeah, which is great. Because the jokes that like that don't get in, I could just use for my act.
Oh, okay.
Some of them. I mean, some of them is just like for example, like, I don't know if it's going to get in, but I'll be like, a new study says that you could catch depression through kissing. This explains why this man's so happy. And it's like you. So like
that is, you mean me.
Yeah.
So you write the hit pieces on me. It's not really Greg. It's Adam Hunter.
No, it's all of us. But I don't know if that's – I don't know if I just ruined that joke for, like, the show tonight. But whatever. But, yeah, there's, like, another one I wrote about you that I'll, like, show you off the air. That I think it's, like, more appropriate.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
So what was I going to ask you? So a couple of things. Last night's show, really good coming off vacation. Did you guys meet on Monday for that? Did you write it all on the same day?
No, we got the topics on Monday, and it's hard. Sometimes you get them at like a night, like at 10 at night, 11 at night.
On Memorial Day.
Yeah, and then it's like, hey, and they do a great job as far as like, you know, 8 different topics for like the monologue, and then they'll be like this, and they like, oh, this is Trump, the whole Trump stories, or this stories, or that stories, and then we get into just other stories. And then also I'll go through the New York Post or Fox News or whatever, and then go through those, because a lot of times like they like the setups are like right there. And
so
then
I know comedians don't like to comment on comedians, but I do watch the late night shows. I tape the Tonight Show every night just to see if there's something that could help this show in particular. You bump in. I mean, the Daily Show on Mondays, really good. Jon Stewart's fantastic, right?
Yeah.
His delivery. And we used a lot of it the other week because he couldn't believe Jake Tapper wrote the book he did either. I mean, the absurdity goes beyond conservative media. But for the most part, listen, I watched every night of Letterman my whole life. Carson, it still pops up. You see the humor. I don't know what happened in the humor. It's more statements. They're like statements about how crazy he is or how bad this is, and clapping, not laughs. Do you notice the different approach?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is like, you know, it used to just be comedy is comedy, right? Yeah. Like, even if you watch, like, I used to love Married with Children, and Al Bundy had like the greatest fat jokes ever in like the shoe store. People would come in and they'd be like, oh, you know, does this make me look fat? And what, The Room? I mean, whatever it was just so mean, but it was hilarious.
Right.
It was, and it didn't matter. And then they got into this thing of like, oh, you guys should only punch up, only make fun of people who are doing better than you. But then you're like, well, who's decide who's up?
Right.
Who are you? So it's like whenever I do a comedy show and if there's a handicapped person in the crowd or whatever it is, I make fun of everybody because everyone wants to be made fun of equally, you know?
Right.
But some reason people go, oh, they're not good enough to be made fun of, or they're too sensitive, or they can't take a joke. And you're like, why are we not treating everyone equally?
Absolutely.
So then
equally bad.
Equally bad. So then what happens, I think, on these shows is that on the Tonight Show, they go, okay, there's so many filters. So, oh, we can't make fun of this person because they'll get upset. Or we can't make fun of this person because I got upset. Oh, well, this is too much. This is too mean here. This is too mean. So now you have like 3 people that you could say, okay, we're going to make fun of, which is going to be Donald Trump. And it's going to be
Donald Trump,
MAGA,
JD Vance.
Right. So now you could every night. It's
Musk.
Just about that. Whereas like Greg, I mean, Greg takes shots at everybody, and
right.
And it doesn't matter skinny, fat, old, young, white, black. It's just comedy for comedy. He literally says nobody's off limits.
Not many people say this, but Jerry Nadler plays a very valuable role in your life, right? I mean, people like that. I mean, you have give Jerry Nadler more publicity than anybody.
Oh, I mean, like the other day, I mean, I remember I wrote a joke about like, I mean, it was so stupid, but about like, they're like, you know, Democrats say that they're like, people were like explaining, you know, what animal represents their thing. And it was like, oh, well, you know, Republicans are like lions and Democrats are like, I don't know, snails. And then I wrote like, well, what about the cows? And it's like The View. So it's always
The
View is always of like, oh, they love Joy Behar in India because cows are sacred. And then it's just, those are the best because I don't know. This is funny. It's just, the thing is, The View's not even big. They're not even like big people. It's just funny to me.
Oh, I know. You make them big. So how do you feel like when you saw the video of Macron get pushed in the face by his wife, your sense is, I don't want to insult the French, so I'm going to back off?
Or No. Right. Even yesterday on the show, I said she was probably mad because he was wearing deodorant. You know, so
that was great.
Right away, because people know that like the French didn't really wear deodorant. It's like kind of a new thing in France is deodorant. I mean, like the
they
last
don't shave their armpits.
50
that's
years.
True.
Yeah. So that's there. The whole thing about Macron being his wife being trans, that thing was like, I guess they're a little sensitive because I don't know, maybe she some issues there. So it was issues,
I mean,
there.
It was a 30-year gap.
Yeah.
They met at 15. She was 39.
He was a teacher. But that would, in the U.S., that would be a huge scandal. If a teacher dated a drama teacher, dated her student, and then got married. But even on the show, I said, like, Macron seems to be like, Like Trump's always arm wrestling him. And then last week, some guy was like pulling his finger.
You saw that?
Yeah. And now he's getting smacked. Like,
what's this guy?
It's like the Mr. Bean. What's that guy that always falls down back in the day? Like people. And that's basically why he's like Chevy Chase in SNL back in the 70s.
And meanwhile, he is all about sophistication and the tight fitting suits. But in his real life, it's all falling apart. Doesn't it also show you that everyone's like his life is, even though he's president of France?
Yeah.
Just like everybody else, you get in arguments and sometimes your wife pushes you in the face.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed like it was a smack, though. It didn't seem like it was a push.
What do you think, Allison? Do you think it was a smack or you think it was a push? I felt like she pushed his face. Like,
it was like a combination in between, but I also feel like it seemed like it was a very normal thing for her to do to him, but who does that to their spouse?
And by the way, and then he tried to grab her hand. Oh, did you see there was lip reading in New York Post? Did you see that? And she said, at least pretend or something. I think we have it. Lip reading to find out what went wrong there. So Eva goes, at least pretend or at least fake it like that we're getting along. I know what happened. You know what happened.
What happened?
There's no doubt about it that he had an affair.
You think so?
Yeah. That's the type, that's what you do. You push him in the face. He's like, oh, come on. What's the big deal? You're so much older than me. Is probably what he said.
I mean, maybe. I mean, look, when you're younger, when you're 17 and the girl's like 37, it's creepy, but there's something like, oh, wow, she's an older woman, you know? You're like, oh, when you're 25 and she's 45 and she knows her stuff. But then you get to be like 60 and she's 80.
Listen, they're there.
And then it's just an 80-year-old woman at that point. You're like, I mean, maybe they have like an open relationship or something. I mean, he is the leader of a country. But
right. Hey, do we have any Scott Pelley? Yeah, can we play a little of this? Tell me if you think this is appropriate for Adam Hunter. Did you graduate college?
Yeah, no, I didn't graduate college.
Did you try?
I went to Binghamton.
Right, and what happened?
And then I dropped out because I ended up getting sued for $20 million for causing a riot on campus with my television show called These Nuts. And but they threw it went to the Supreme Court of Brooklyn. They threw it out of court. But it was so much fun having that show. It's a long story.
So you had a show in college?
I had one show one night, and then it got banned. In fact, they banned all television shows at SUNY Binghamton.
What did you do?
Nothing. What happened was I used to wrestle in college, and I was cutting weight all the time, losing 20 pounds. So we used to call and prank call the TV station, the local television station, and they would try to have like real. Could you curse on this show or no? Or
I'd rather you know.
Okay, so they'd be like, I'd be like, hey, do you know Devane? And I'm like, who Devane? And my, you know, just whatever we would say. They would try to have a conversation. Anyway, so then I ended up wanting my own show because I quit the wrestling team, and I was like, I got to do something with my life. So they gave me my own show, and it was Monday night. And then people were then making fun of me. Like, everything I was doing to other people, they were doing to me. Like,
you had your own show. It was campus television.
Yeah, on campus television. Anyway, this girl calls up, and she's like, hey, you swept me at the gym, and you're going to talk, and I see you checking me out. Not true. At the gym, I was cutting weight. I was not. But anyway, she's like, my name is so-and-so, and everyone's going to make fun of me. So then everyone started calling in to make fun of her. So then she decided to jump on in front of the television. She came out to the studio, stood in front of the camera, and was like, all you people that are made, and then the whole school was
this
now.
This is one show.
One first show. Now all these people are making fun of her, right? I'm laughing, but I'm sticking up for her. Then she leaves. Then the guy that she was making fun of, this guy on the soccer team, Seth Thomas, who was like the captain of the team, he came down and started like getting into it with her. And it was like Jerry Springer, basically.
On a show.
They end up going back to their room. People start throwing water balloons at her. They canceled all the shows. She sues the school for $20 million, me for $20 million. And the kid Seth for $20 million. My dad's like, you go to college for 1 week, and you come home with a $20 million lawsuit. Like, can't you just go to class like everyone else? But I was like, this is so much fun. I want my own talk show. So I'm like, I want to be a talk show host. This is great. So then I dropped out of college, and I ended up going to Hofstra for a year, and then Hunter for a semester. I didn't finish, but that's how I got into comedy, basically.
And then you just started from there. And how many years ago was that?
25 years ago.
Wow. Doing comedy. You're doing great. So your parents are no longer worried.
My dad used to manage Alice Cooper, so he was like in show business.
He understands it.
Yeah, he kind of understands it. He does understand it. But it was hard. I mean, look, I started off doing comedy every day in Times Square, giving out flyers, barking, begging people to come to shows. I can't tell you how many times I've slept in my car at night. I've driven to San Diego from California with like No money. If I didn't have
you
a
mean
good
from
set,
Los Angeles, India?
Yeah. If I didn't have a good set, I wouldn't be able to have enough gas to get back. You know, I was, you know, looking through my couches for quarters and nickels and dimes to get McDonald's. And I mean, just travel all around the world. But, you know, it's the last, since like when I got on Last Comic Standing and I was a finalist, and even that was a whole nother, another story. It's been going really well, like since then, basically. I've been to Tonight Show twice. I've been on a couple world tours. Like this year, I was in Australia opening for Russell Peters, went to New Zealand, Japan, Korea, China,
that?
Thailand.
Do they think you're funny in these other countries? Do they get your humor?
Yeah, I mean, in South Korea and the Philippines, like you go out there and it takes a second to translate. Like, because I'm the opener, so I go on cold, and I could see them like basically filtering my jokes from Mandarin to English. Like, so the first couple minutes are a little tough because it's just the rhythm thing.
Wow.
And then at minute 4 or 5, they catch on. And then from 5 to 25, because I was doing 25 minutes, then that would be really good.
And do you like read through the Filipino newspapers?
No, I mean there's some basic stuff, you know, like we went to Thailand and we walked around like the red light district, and one girl was like, oh, you want one girl? You want two girl? And I held up my wedding ring and the girl's like, oh, you want 5 girls? I mean, there's a lot of basic things that just happen that you're like, oh, this is hilarious. I mean, when I was in, we went to Saudi Arabia, we went to Doha, actually. Doha was crazy because, you know, the audience is like all covered up. A lot of the women are just, I mean, they're wearing like cloth. All you can see is their eyes.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Russell, how do we know if people are laughing? And they're like, oh, you're just going to see their bodies move back and forth. And which was the case, literally the case.
So they can't make noise?
They can make noise, but
you can't see their mouth.
It's, you know,
crazy.
And then also like, you know, a lot of the guys have 4 wives over there. So, and Russell told me, he's like, hey, don't compliment people's stuff because they're very proud people here. So if you're like, hey, nice watch, they'll be like, oh, you want it, my friend? They'll just try to give it to you. Money's nothing to a lot of these people. It's like, so I'm like, hey, I told the guy, like, your wife is pretty. And he's like, oh, you want her? I have 3 more. those kind of things you kind of pick up.
I don't know if it translates to America,
yeah. But
you kind of got to leave it there. All right, more with Adam Hunter in a moment. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Adam will tell us exclusively where he's going to be next.
Yes.
This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we are back, and Adam Hunter is off to St. Louis right after this. KTFK is, I knew that, KFTK, one of our great affiliates, went to St. Louis. Where are you going to be, Adam? Where are you tomorrow night?
I'm at the St. Charles Funny Bone Thursday to Saturday, and then the following week I'm in Naples, Florida at Off the Hook Comedy Club.
So those comedy clubs, you'll just go in and you'll headline, you get out.
Yeah.
Someone's booking you from California.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So how does your family handle it when you're away so much?
It's hard. It's definitely hard. You know, sometimes like, I mean, it's one of those things where like, I've been married like 8 years and my wife's like, you know, I'm on the road and she's like, I miss you. I'm like day one, and then I love you, day two, and then like day four, it's like, when are you coming home? I didn't sign up for this. And then I come home, and then she's like, oh, I love you. And then it was like, when are you leaving after like being home for 2 days?
So these 2 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I tell you what, I just think in the long run, you have kids though, right?
Yeah, I have one little daughter.
And you like her?
The best.
Yeah. And how old is she?
She's six.
So she wants you home all the time.
Oh, I mean, that's the hardest. Like, she grabs my leg and she's like, you're not leaving. You need to retire. You know, I talk to my lawyer. But I take her with me sometimes. If it's in Arizona or Vegas or Reno, if a place that I could drive to, and then she does my merch table. Like, if I sell t-shirts, she'll do it. But then she gets upset if, like, no one buys the t-shirt. So sometimes I'll give people money. And then they'll go to the t-shirt and buy it off her, and then they give you money back. I take it back.
Like, right. Let me just try to make one suggestion. Best thing we ever did. I do History, Liberty, and Laughs, and we're going to be in Dayton, Ohio, June 21st. We got a t-shirt gun.
Oh,
after
wow.
We shoot at the t-shirts, people die for it. Then you can get the same one outside.
Oh, you're right.
But it's hard to travel with because they don't like to bring that, the whole guns thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Once had a person in Vegas, I'm not even kidding, I had my t-shirts outside the comedy club, like right outside, and in Vegas, this old woman in a wheelchair grabbed like 10 shirts and started rolling away with them, like an electric wheelchair. And then someone's like, she just stole your shirts. So then I ran and took it from her. And then people thought I was robbing. And people had their phones out. Like, and they're like, I'm like, no, that's not. People thought I was like stealing from a wheelchair lady. Like, yeah, like that's exactly. It was crazy.
That is. And what is the message? Do not let people in wheelchairs to your shows? Is that the message?
They could come to the shows. I don't think she even came to the show. I think she was just It was like one of those things. It was like open. It was like in a casino. Yeah.
And if you would, how much do I pay you not to put me on Gutfeld every night? Is there a figure?
No. They. You know what's funny, though? The crowd likes you so much. They laugh at Jesse and they go, aw, whenever you come up.
Right. But it hasn't stopped you.
No, of course not.
All right. Yeah. Now I know you're complicit and might even be the architect. Adam Hunter, thanks so much.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade. Thanks so much for listening. Yes, I'm the same Brian Kilmeade who will be on stage, coming up already. June 21st in Ohio, at Dayton, Ohio. It's going to be great. I'm also going to be in Dallas, Texas, August 23rd, and then on the 27th in Richmond, Virginia. So History, Liberty, and Laughs. We have some fun on stage and have a chance to talk about what's happening in the news, what's happening in our past through my 7 history books and 2 sports books. And then, of course, get a chance to meet you in person. This hour, we're going to be joined by Mark Penn, as well as to get the Democratic perspective on where we're at politically now that Rahm Emanuel basically says I'm running for president, and then Karl Rove is standing by. So let's get to the big three.
Number 3.
According to the New York Times, Democrats are dropping $20 million on a new project. It's called Codenamed SAM, short for Speaking with American Men, a strategic plan, and it promises investment to study the syntax, language, and content that gains attention and virality in these spaces.
It's even hard for the great Dana Perino to say with a straight face, Dems regrouping in terrible ways, with a terrible message and with terrible operations. I'll explain.
Number 2.
What Trump is basically doing is saying, actually, no, we're actually not going to do this anymore. We're not going to make the hardest working people subsidize the lives of the fabulously wealthy. We're going to do the opposite. We're going to take $3 billion from Harvard and give it to trade schools so that working class people can afford to buy homes.
Yes, Harvard, you can't win. As Trump gets more aggressive with the Ivy institution, why I believe the focus on Harvard has been losing just because they're focusing, even if Harvard goes on to win in some of the court battles.
Number 1.
Any further step of Putin into the rest of Ukraine, we will immediately favorably consider requests for weapons and trainers on the ground. We have to make it plain that he's got to stop where he is.
That is Charles Krauthammer back in 2014, how he knew Vladimir Putin. Putin now in 2025 pushed too far with Donald Trump and loses, in my view, his best ally in the West as his major offensive and insincere ceasefire talks have Trump ready to slap sanctions and I hope give Ukraine massive weapons. And let's bring in Karl Rove on that. Karl, have you had a chance to meet Vladimir Putin in all your travels?
Oh, sure. With President Bush, met him several times. He's a tiny guy, and he is, like a lot of small people, he throws his shoulders around. There's a sense of arrogance about the guy, he's a thug. And, he's changed. He was in the early 2000s, after he first came to power, he was trying to figure things out and was sort of tentative, but he was radicalized by the explosion of liberty and freedom in the so-called color revolutions of 2004. And after that point became very concerned about what he saw as the predominant position of the former, Soviet empire, the former Russian empire in that part of the world. And felt that the growth of democracy in places like Poland and the Baltics and the Czech Republic and Slovakia and Hungary, et cetera, Ukraine, most of all, were a threat.
And obviously he's acting on it and he's getting some positive reinforcement. In retrospect, now he's knee deep in this war. Well, J.D. Vance said something interesting that kind of plays into the Wall Street Journal story today. He said, I don't know if Putin knows how to get out of this.
And then the Wall Street Journal says that 45% of his economy is military-based, that they're building howitzers and tanks and ammunition, and that's what's keeping that country employed?
Yeah, but it's being how are they doing that? They're selling oil to our to America's adversaries via surreptitious means, and frankly, at lower than international prices because they're so desperate to get sales. That's unsustainable over the long haul. And the question is, you know, how long can he sustain it? You know, a West that is united, that says we will not allow Russia to take by force and destroy its neighbors simply because they are living in liberty and are oriented towards the West, not towards the East. If we and our European allies stand up and say no, then the end is coming for Putin sooner rather than later.
Look, Zelensky wants to buy the weapons to Patriots. And sadly, it looks like we don't have the production to get it to him without stripping our own protection. So they're urging, the U.S. is now urging our neighbors to give them Patriots that we've maybe allowed them to purchase. Here's Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, cut two.
He's tried to work with Putin. His patience is running thin. And you and I know President Trump personally. When he's done with you, he's done. And if Putin continues to push this envelope the way that he is, he's going to give Zelensky the tools he needs to fight back on the full scale and full support of the United States. But Europe needs to take a lead. This isn't our fight. This isn't in our backyard. This is Europe's backyard.
So, I mean, Senator Mark Wayne Mullen, a close confidant of the president, he's speaking, I think he's almost hoping, so are Republicans in the Senate, with 80-plus votes in support of severe sanctions with details that Lindsey Graham, I guess, authored. They're ready to go with this. It's veto-proof.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, let's talk about Putin for just a second. What is he doing? There are two explanations. One is that he's making a big mistake, that he is sitting there, you know, saying, I can bully the Ukrainians and ignore Trump, and so I'm moving forward, and nothing's going to stop me, and I'm going to play Trump for a sucker. The other one is that he says I know that there's a point at which I'm going to have to you know, appease Trump, but in the meantime I intend to push this as far as I can to get as much territory and as much leverage, and hopefully. What happens is that the last tranche of U.S. aid, which was made under Biden, runs out, that leaves Ukraine in a highly vulnerable position, and it's, you know, it's unable to defend itself because the new aid is not flowing. Now, you know, one's stupidity and the other is a calculated gamble. I think he is taking the calculated gamble. I think he hopes that the U.S. aid runs out, that the Europeans don't step up, that the U.S. doesn't step up in time, and so that he has a major breakthrough in which he takes either large chunks of the country or takes the country entirely itself. But he's, you know, that's a dangerous gamble because he's clearly, you know, he's clearly showing disrespect to Trump.
I know, and it was his, and I just thought he was smarter than that. I don't say he's not evil, but I also thought he was one of these street smart guys who understands he's got this rare opportunity for a guy who said, I could help you get your economy going right away. Let's just do it. You shut it down. We'll do some agricultural deals. We're going to do some rare earth deals. We'll help you with the transition. Not another American president would have done that, nor a Western leader. And I thought he would have recognized that.
Yeah. And look, there's $300 billion of Russian assets that are locked up in Europe. What he's gambling is that he can get Trump to release those $300 billion in assets.
Sure.
And that helps his economy regain its footing. On the other hand, that's one of the ultimate cards that Trump has. He could say to the Europeans, go ahead and see, you're holding those assets. Turn those assets over to the use of the Ukrainians. And in that case, it'd be a very problematic issue for the Russians.
All right, so I want to talk about what's happening with Harvard and the White House. They now have frozen. The State Department has decided to freeze all international students to further notice. There's about 1.3 million who come to our universities, big and small, not just elite institutions around the country. And now the president has already shut off additional funds that were going to go to Harvard. Here's the press secretary, Caroline Levitt, Cut 14.
I watched
the left-wing cable media, CNN, on my television in the White House all day today, and they were up in arms over the president's common sense policy when it comes to federal funding for Harvard. And not a single one of those left-wing reporters can answer the question of why an institution that is pushing anti-American values with a $53 billion endowment should receive a single penny of taxpayer funds. And the president is more interested in giving that taxpayer money to trade schools, in programs, in state schools, where they are promoting American values, but most importantly, educating the next generation based on skills that we need in our economy and our society. Apprenticeships, electricians, plumbers. We need more of those in our country.
So he wants to redirect the money to trade schools. He froze $100 million in all to going to Harvard. They sued back. So I think by exposing it, Harvard's losing even more, support.
Well, first of all, let's see the president's proposal. If this is so important to give the millions, hundreds of millions of dollars that Harvard was receiving to apprenticeship programs and to community colleges and trade schools, let's see the proposal.
Have a press conference, right, with the trade school presidents.
Yeah, well, but it's also, look, he has to have either authority in existing statutes or, more likely, new authority. He certainly has to have the permission of the U.S. Congress to spend the money that way. And if it's a new program, he's got to go to the Congress. We are not in an era of kings again. It is not King George III. So he's got to go to the Congress and ask for it. But the other thing is,
Can you redirect? Can you redirect without going to Congress?
Well, if there's an existing program, moving money from one program to another, if it's moving it, it gets complicated. But in all likelihood, he's going to have to go to Congress and ask for what's called a rescission, the authority of Congress, approval of Congress to move money from one kind of a program to an entirely different kind of a program. This is not like we're moving stuff within the budget for the Department of Defense. This may be, moving it from the Department of Education to the Department of Labor, and that will require Congress to agree.
Lastly, when it comes to politics, I've never seen the Democratic Party in more disarray. Rahm Emanuel says it's toxic. I'm running as a centrist. AOC and Bernie Sanders, huge crowds because they're running against the oligarchy. And now you have the unmasking of a zombie president in Joe Biden. It's even more exposed than even you and I probably thought it would be, because you have a left-wing anchor co-writing a book. So your thoughts about where this party is right now, that party is?
Well, it's broken, and it's at war with each other. Now, some of this happens after you lose a big presidential election. No ifs, ands, or buts. But this is worse. But I will say this. I think it's interesting, with maybe the exception of 1972 and George McGovern, the people in the modern era who have ended up leading the Democratic Party have not been the most left-wing candidates. So, AOC and Bernie get big crowds in weird places like, Idaho and Utah. But at the end of the day, somebody like Rahm Emanuel, who's more towards the center of the American politics, admittedly a liberal, but more towards the center of American politics than Bernie and AOC, is likely to be the Democratic nominee.
Really?
And that's my view, and history suggests that. Think about it. With maybe the exception of Michael Dukakis, who was more a technocrat but also was very liberal, the Democratic Party has tended to pick people who are sort of more mainstream in the nature of being Democrats, particularly in this century, if they want to win. So I also think, because of Biden, this is likely to be an election in which, if you were not in the cabinet and not in the Biden administration, seeing him on a regular basis, you got a better chance of winning. That is to say, governors, like the governor of Kentucky, or the governor of Michigan, or the governor of Colorado, all of the governor of Pennsylvania, the governor of Maryland, they all have a better shot, in my opinion, in 2028, because they don't have to answer the question of, didn't you see how bad he was in the meetings you had with him? And remember, Rahm Emanuel is on the other side of the world. Yes, he was in the Biden administration, but he's the ambassador in Japan, sitting in Tokyo, mixing it up in the East. So
you know, it's going to be a really interesting contest to see how they put mm-hmm. themselves back together. But you mentioned in your intro this $20 million study
yeah.
of, you know, what about males. How do we talk to males? We have to do so in a deep voice, you know, and yeah, how's your, you know, and what beer do you like? You know, what sports do you follow? I mean, it sounds like Margaret Mead, you know, an anthropologist floating around, you know, some weird island in the South Pacific with a, you know, a people who have never been, you know, met by the humanity. I mean, it's like, you know, some anthropologist deep in the jungles of Africa looking at, you know, we're studying gorillas. I mean, it's like weird.
It is crazy. But also you have to do it at a Four Seasons and cost a lot of money. That's where having these meetings, how to meet men, excuse me, how to win over men. Carl Rove, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
You bet. All the best.
All right. Back in a moment.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
If you dig in on what Democrats are researching right now, you're going to find a lot of silly stuff. You're going to find people asking a lot of questions, people asking about syntax and do I drop the G from
right.
this word and this and that. And it's going to be a lot of that. So let me just warn everybody, that process is going to be very obnoxious. We're really talking about young men,
right?
Young men who Democrats have not figured out a consistent pitch for how to get in front of. And I think it starts with authenticity. Stop creating purity tests for people because they don't agree with you 8 or 9 times.
Right.
That's just a Democratic strategist weighing in about how to get people back. I mean, it's not hard. You don't have to work on a car to impress a man or watch a game or, I don't know, drink a beer. It's a joke. I don't even get it. But everything that they've said over the last few years, they've had to run. America's a racist country based on the 1619 Project. Men suck. And they trans. How dare you bring up trans men in women's sports? Now everything's reversed. It's all. I've always said we're a self-correcting country. This is the best example yet. We fixed all the cancel culture stuff. We stopped with the DEI. The Supreme Court overturned affirmative action. We've become more of a balanced playing field. We have a situation where we are pushing towards a meritocracy. We are looking to be more aggressive but more responsible overseas. We are building up our defense once again. There is more of a national pride coming up for year 250. And Democrats, for the most part, think that they are off target. And they're all over the place on where to go from here. The next big civil war fight in the Democratic Party will be what Karl Rove alluded to at the end and I brought up last week. You have Xavier Becerra as well as Kamala Harris running for governor in California. They look like they're going to get in. One of them's going to get in. And the other one is this guy, Mayor Villagrosa. Forgot his first name. He was the mayor of Los Angeles. He is more of a centrist Democrat, they say. I couldn't tell you in particular, but that's how he's labeled. Interviewed him a couple of times. Seems pretty rational. He is all over these guys saying, how dare you not speak up and talk about the failings, the cognitive disabilities of Joe Biden. Basically a corpse president that was not doing anything along the way. Should not have run for re-election, probably never should have been elected, and you never spoke up. So it's going to eliminate the Pete Buttigieg's of the world that wanted to run. I don't know if Anthony Blinken ever wants to serve again. You going to tell me he's going to get confirmed after what he did or Jake Sullivan did? Knowing they were supposedly in constant contact with Joe Biden? Guess what? They weren't. They ran their own foreign policy almost entirely. Didn't tell anybody. When we come back, inside Mark Penn, inside the Democratic Party, Mark Penn, former pollster with the Clinton people, more of a centrist now. We can talk about what's going on, also the challenges Donald Trump might have, especially with the midterms coming up. Brian Kilmeade here. Don't move.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Very lucid, very well informed. He speaks
quietly and a little bit slowly, but, you know.
He's totally focused. He's very sharp. And the proof is in the performance.
But comparing that guy's mental state, I've said it for years now. He's cogent. Mm-hmm. But I undersold him when I said he was cogent. He's far beyond cogent. In fact, I think he's better than he's ever been intellectually. Analytically?
I mean, look, that was, as I said, it was a cheap, a cheap fake. That was definitely a cheap fake. It was.
I think that you were mocking his stutter.
I had no idea, Joe Biden.
Yeah, I think you were mocking his stutter, and I think you have absolutely no standing to diagnose somebody's cognitive decline.
So that was just so damning, even no matter how many times you listen to it, because we heard it in real time. I would play on this show. How could you actually watch him on the stage wander off into the Amazon, wander off with Maloney at the G20? You see him scream things out arbitrarily. This guy can't stay in power on his Russia speech in Ukraine. How many times are we going to watch him mumble his way through speeches that are on the prompter before people just say, of course he's not with it, let alone run again? Here's Jake Tapper admitting that Lara Trump was right.
She was right, and I was wrong. I did not see in the moments he was having, I did not see that as cognitive decline. She did. Our reporting suggests that she was correct. So I feel humility. I have apologized to her.
My reporting, the reporting is your reporting or whatever Alex Thompson did and let you put your name on. So Lara Trump finally responded, said, what really did happen with Jake Tapper?
Jake Tapper called me about 2 months ago, actually. And he said, I have this book coming out, and I know everybody's saying that I should apologize to you. I plan, whenever the book comes out, to go on TV, and I will say, you were right, and I was wrong. It feels a little bit too late to me. I do appreciate that he did keep his word, though, and come out and say that I was right.
It wasn't a stutter. Mark Penn joins us now. Mark, you were also one of the people who knew that Biden was not okay. He was not functioning well. To begin with, you've said that all along. Why did you feel free to say that when so many other people in a party you spent a lot of your life in weren't?
Well, look, you can't let partisanship dictate facts, right? You're going to have to look at facts as they are, as you see them, you know, and I think this is an interesting study in the ability. Look, the Democrats convinced 45% of the people until that debate that he was competent, and the press, frankly, he never sat down for an interview. I mean, the only interview he really did was the her interview, and then the only time he was on his own and couldn't depend on notes and pre-programmed questions. I mean, you could see the operation that was going on in order to prevent this. But, you know, people in the Democratic Party wanted him to do what he was doing. And they were getting what they wanted by whoever was controlling the presidency. So, you know, everybody went along with it. And, you know, the truth really came out afterward. And it came out in a way that was undeniable. I mean, the shock and horror. If you sat there and watched that debate, the shock and horror that people had in how he did in that debate, calling out about how we defeated Medicare or whatever it was, was unbelievable. I mean, it was unbelievable, right?
And because it was over the top, considering I was not that shocked to see him. Like, yeah, he was terrible. But I watched him at different events where I go, you know, we play sound bites on the radio show. I go, I have no idea what he just said. But then he fell apart. So this leads me to one thing, just your opinion. After seeing this book and seeing everyone come out and say how bad he was and the Politburo around him that even kept cabinet secretaries away, do you believe that somebody pushed for that debate in June that wanted him out? Because nobody was clamoring while Donald Trump was in New York at these trials and is trying to get through the civil trial and the criminal trial and knew what was coming up next. He comes out and says, hey, I want to debate you. Now we know a highly edited spot. He goes, I hear you're off on Wednesdays. And I think to myself, what? Why do you want to debate him? Of course he's going to say. And Trump said, yeah, I'll debate you any rules. Doesn't matter. Like, who did that knowing? Everybody who knew him well knew he couldn't perform well. Why did they do that?
I thought that at first, I will have to say, and I said at the time, when people were interviewing, saying, it's very odd that debate is when it is, because it's the only thing that could possibly derail his nomination is that debate.
Yes.
Had they just not done the debate, yes, until the nomination was sealed, that would have been it. There would have been no going back, no matter how crazy he was on the stage, right? And so I was shocked at that. And for a while, I thought that. But it really appeared to be that they just underestimated Donald Trump, that they thought it really didn't matter what Joe Biden would say. Donald Trump would fall apart, right, and be seen as the way they saw Donald Trump. Because you have to understand, the distorted view that they had of Donald Trump was so bad and so negative and so beyond, you know, what you could really, what the American public saw in that debate, because also I've asked all my friends, was there somebody, did somebody, was, you know, somebody like Anita Dunn, was it a setup? And really the answer would seem to be no, right? And I think it would have been discovered by now in the Tapper book. And one thing I want to say about Tapper, you know, I went back in 2016 and I was trying to find who actually called 2016, because remember, nobody, very few people thought Donald Trump could win in 2016. And the only person I found who called it correctly, state by state, with the reason, was Kellyanne Conway. And she did it in an interview with Jake Tapper, and he laughs at her the entire interview. You know?
Really?
So, you know, it's really something for Tapper to try to, you know, put on kind of a saint hat here when yes, he was wrong. You know, and he was part of the conspiracy to, you know, Joe Biden, right or wrong, you know, and so I don't know. It's ironic that was his pattern, right?
Wow. I great research on your part. I didn't, you know, I must have missed that. I do watch other channels and I miss that. And Kellyanne Conway was right about a lot of it, because I talked to her when she first got hired, and she's a lot of the stuff that she said when she first got hired, because she was a contributor here first. And she's like, oh, yeah, we got these states, this state, this state. And I'm thinking to myself, wow, that's pretty bold. He goes, no, we'll be able to do this. And I thought, okay. And it ended up being right. But I will look for that clip back in 2016. So I got to ask you, I remember succinctly when Mitt Romney lost to Barack Obama. The autopsy that took place, Michael Steele left a huge debt. The autopsy that took place, we're going to fix this. We're going to make sure we talk better about the border to not alienate Hispanics. We're going to change everything. The autopsy never took place. Donald Trump came in and disrupted everything, and he ended up winning. And we know the Trump era, we're in the middle of it right now. So what do the Democrats do? Because as I look at this, you see that the people that are getting the biggest crowds are AOC and Bernie Sanders. I don't really see the moderate. Senator Fetterman is highly ridiculed. Rahm Emanuel comes out and says, I'll be in the middle and our party's in disarray. And then I see what's happening with the governor's race. Becerra and Kamala Harris are being attacked now by Villagrosa for people that covered up Joe Biden's decline. So I'm wondering, if I look at this party and take a stand over it, 3,000-foot view, 30,000-foot view, I see a mess. What does Mark Pence see?
Yeah, there's no coherent or organized Democratic Party right now, nor would I really expect there to be. Look, there's the left has grown in power very significantly in the Democratic Party. You they had a deal with Joe Biden or Jill Biden or whoever the deal was to basically get all the appointments and all the judges and you know, a lot of the bills. And the moderates were basically quiet, and the one or two that stood up on a couple of issues are no longer there. But it isn't an unwinnable position. It can't win with the extreme positions that the left is trying to sell. You know, AOC can generate a crowd, but she's not going to generate a crowd that's going to get, you know, more than 20-25% of the country. And so there is no organized Democratic Party. The Democratic Party has in the past, you know, worked itself up. I always point out 72, they got one state, 84, they got one state. The Republicans were in the wilderness for a long time, in the 40s and the 50s, till they came back with Eisenhower. So parties can go out and can be disorganized and can be out of step, right, for a while. And sure, there's going to be an open primary. And until there's a primary, and look, there'll be the midterm. So the midterms, you know, might, you know, bring something back in terms of House, of coherence. Yeah. But I'm hard pressed to see that is the case. They'll mostly will just run against, you know, have the security of running against Trump. So they all can they all can parrot that message without much help. So come the presidential election, you know, it's they're not going to be running against Trump anymore. They're going to be running against a fresh Republican candidate, and they're going to have a Democratic candidate who can get more than 25% of the vote. And you know, that's not a certainty, right? It's not a certainty at all right now.
So, Mark, listen to this speculation. I never thought about it until this morning. Is that if the House flips, it might be bad for Democrats, because what's going to happen? We're going to impeach Donald Trump. We're going to investigate Marco Rubio. We're going to find out what happened with USAID. And all the investigations, everything will be about Trump. And again, they'll be off message. It won't be what the party's about. It'll be, I'm against Trump in every way. I'm going to make my name in oversight. I'm going to make my name with this investigation. And one of the worst things to happen to Democrats is not to focus on who their next candidate is. It'll be focusing on blowing up this administration. How do you feel about that theory?
Yeah, I doubt that a Democratic victory in the House will usher in a new era of bipartisanship. No, that's not happening. And, you know, the parties are both they're a long way from that. I think it could happen. It could very well roll out that way. But look, there's not going to be any order in the Democratic Party until there is a presidential candidate who will really take over the reins of the party and set its direction. And whether that's going to, you know, look, what happened that other time before what happened in 2020 was effectively a deal in which Joe Biden was put up kind of as a fake moderate, right, in order to prevent Bernie Sanders becoming the nominee. I don't, you know, there's not going to be a capability either the Bernie Sanders wing / AOC is going to win, or they're going to be defeated by somebody like a Josh Shapiro. And there's going to be a real fight. And I suppose there could be a real fight in the Republican Party too, right? I mean, it's not there.
I think that Nikki Haley's going to be running. I think that JD and Rubio will run. Maybe they'll combine. I don't know. I think DeSantis is going to run again. So I think there'll be. But, you know, Mark, one thing I would love for the country, center left. The left wing scares me. Center left does not scare me. It just have differing on certain views. But there's some commonalities. The Bernie Sanders, the AOCs, that kind of scares me. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you. Talk to you again soon.
Bro. Mark Penn, always great. I mean, what an hour. Karl Rove and Mark Penn, you don't get better political talk than that. Keep it here. I'm going to find out if there's indeed more to know next. And don't forget, on the top of the hour, I'm an outnumbered. And to see me on Fox Nation, BrianKilmeade.com on stage.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
You right now should come out and be like, you know what? The young man who's about to win the state championship in the long jump in female sports,
right.
that shouldn't happen. You as right. the governor should step out say no.
No, and I appreciate it. But
would you do something like that? Would you say no men in female sports?
Well, I think it's an issue of fairness. I completely agree with you on that.
So
that's easy to call out, the unfairness of that.
Right. So there you go. Hi, everyone. This is Brian Kilmeade. We're back. I'm going to be outnumbered shortly, but it makes me wonder if there's more to know.
More to know. Sponsored by Prevagen. Prevagen, made for your brain.
So right now, that was the beginning of More to Know, and that was Gavin Newsom talking to Charlie Kirk. But now we got an issue, because now we have a man, trans man, in women's sports, ruining high school for school athletes eligible for track and field. The guy is winning everything because he's pretending to be a woman. 90% of the people agree with me and the President of the United States. The California Interscholastic Federation does not. They who governs the sports. They say athletes who are identified as birth as female fell one spot short of making the cut for the upcoming state championship because this person decided to be a male. Here is Steve Hilton, who's running for governor to replace Newsom. Cut 39.
There's no leadership
from Gavin Newsom at all on this. President Trump is completely right, and he's speaking, as he so often does, for the vast majority of Americans, the normal majority, who can't understand why we're even having this conversation, this absurdity. I mean, years ago, would have laughed at this. And by the way, it's not just the competing in the sports. It's yep. being in the locker rooms, on school trips, all of these things. Gavin Newsom has done nothing about it. He's so passive, standing back and, well, I'm just the governor. I can't do anything. Yep. Well, how ridiculous. It is putting girls in danger, not just emotionally, but physically. Yep. He needs to act now.
So he's going to be taking money away. They're going to speak to Governor Newsom, see if they get a resolve to this. But the president's going to withhold money until they do it. Next, Skittles. Guess what? They are making amends now that they're in the MAHA movement. I guess we're in the MAHA era. Mars Inc. Skittles candies are no longer going to be made with titanium dioxide, a chemical that whitens foods, brightens colors, and makes candy appear shiny. The additive was banned in the EU in 2022 over concerns that the nanoparticles of the substance might accumulate in the body and damage your DNA. You think?
Didn't mention anything about the, I'm sure, plenty of food coloring and food dyes and all of the rainbow.
It's not just Skittles. What about Razzles? Could that be next?
What you buy on the regular?
I'm sure. Next, WNBA finds no evidence of racist fan behavior at Angel Reese's versus Caitlin Clark's game when they got into a fight. The league launched a probe after the social media accounts alleged that Reese and some of her teammates were on receiving end of some disturbing trash talk. They sound no evidence. They say based on the information gathered to date, the league said, including from relevant fans, teams, and arena staff, as well as audio and video of the game, we have not substantiated it. Because everyone wants to claim racism when it's not there because it freezes everyone in their tracks. Am I right?
No, absolutely. And if you watch the whole play, like from before, like it, yeah, you see, if you just see where Caitlin Clark fouled her, you're like, oh, that seems excessive. But if you watch the whole play, she was just going back at her.
Right. She's got to stand up for herself. Next. Wish we could have a giant shift in education. The words of Kevin Costner. He wants schools to teach more American history. Of course, we know he's an Academy Award winning filmmaker, not just actor. And he says some people are really good at math. They're going to search out math anyway, because that's who they are. They built that way. History was an important subject to emphasize, as everybody can understand where they came from. So he wants to emphasize that. If Trump sees that, Trump should call him. Let him headline that with the Secretary of Education. Don't you agree?
No, absolutely.
Phil Robertson has passed away at the age of 79. He's the head of the Robertson family, Duck Dynasty. Remember, he was a quarterback in college. Him and Terry Bradshaw are on the same team. There's a lot of video of him playing. He died in his Sunday in Louisiana home. Corey posted the news on Facebook saying Phil was a man of God who always tried to remind people that death only meant returning to God's kingdom. Great guy. Had a chance to actually go into his house with Willie Robertson and the whole Robertson family, and Phil's house in particular. Not luxury, but he had so much success. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Thanks so much for listening, and keep it here.
It is time to take the quiz.
It's five questions in less than 5 minutes. We ask people on the streets of New York City to play along. Let's see how you do.
Take the quiz every day at thequiz.fox. Then come back here to see how you did.
Thank you for taking the quiz.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.